Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is a place where we dig deep into shoeboxes stored on the top of wardrobes or under beds, in attics or cellars, to consider picture postcards and explore what it is that causes us to keep hold of these precious cardboard rectangles and what we can learn from them. Each time, I welcome two guests. And it's their postcards that act as little clues to direct us towards memories, mysteries and stories. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm delighted to say that today my guests are historians both, Karen Averby and Alex Mayhew. Alex and Karen, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Hello.
Hi.
Now, Karen Averby is a historian and research consultant, and she researches all kinds of things, especially seaside and industrial heritage and communities, also house histories, historic hotels, and working class history and heritage. She's also dug into 20th century vegetarian restaurants, bell foundries, Victorian toilets, and the most controversial thing of our time, statues. Her latest book, though, tells the story of British seaside hotels. And Karen joins us today bearing a SN8 postmark. What's that?
That is one of my special places that I like to go and visit, Avebury in Wiltshire. Ah. It's a Neolithic monument, which is quite a far cry from what I do today, which is researching the built environment. But I started off my career, well, sort of in heritage years ago, with a huge love for the Neolithic and prehistory in Britain. And Avebury has remained for me that one special place that I visit today, and I just go there and it's calm and it's lovely and it's historic. There are also historic buildings there too, which is a kind of a nice crossover. But it's just very lovely to visit there, whether it's windy, rainy, whatever the weather. I just like to go there and spend time, sometimes with a picnic, sometimes just walking around. But
so is the Neolithic lovely. A kind of antidote to the world of archives because it predates them all?
It does. I mean, that's the thing about prehistory, that, you know, no written record. And yes, it's something altogether different. You find out a lot of information about it from archaeology. I've got a background in archaeology as well. It's a very, very different discipline altogether. But what I love about Avebury as well is seeing how it's been adapted and used and changed over the years by different people, throughout the ages. So you have communities it today in a different way than you would have used it years ago. Farmers, for example, at one point were breaking down the stones to use for building in the local area. So it's just, it means different things to different people over the years. And that's something I like about it. It's timeless, and yet it's very much in the here and now as well.
Karen, do you still send postcards?
Oh, I do. I love sending postcards. I love receiving postcards. It stems from when I was a child, and you'd have to go, when you went on holiday, you'd have to send a postcard to absolutely everybody. You'd come out the shop with handfuls of things it's a lovely thing to do. And I buy postcards as well for myself from places I've visited, whether it's the seaside or a stately home, wherever. So I have quite a big collection of postcards, I could say.
Now, Dr. Alex Mayhew is a fellow at the LSE. He's a historian, working on the cultural, military and social history of war. He has a particular interest in the First World War and combatants' mentalities, and he explores how environment, social grouping, psychology all informed soldiers' frames of reference and their perceptions of crisis. Along the way, and in that work, he has written specifically about the role postcards played in the lives of British troops in the First World War. And we're going to find out a bit about that later. But right now, Alex comes to us with a 0x7 postmark. Am I deciphering that correctly?
Yeah, just about. I mean, the true postmark would be SE13, but I think I originate in 0x7 for my sins.
Where's that?
That is, Heathrop, but it's very close to Chipping Norton, and I have spent my life trying to shun the idea that I'm part of the Chipping Norton set, which I'm not, and Chipping Norton actually has a very strong history of anti-establishmentism, but I think that's been hidden by people like Rebecca Brooks and David Cameron and Jeremy Clarkson over the last few years beneath the veneer
your beloved neighbours.
Exactly. My beloved neighbours.
But that place still has a place in your heart.
Yeah, I think it's hard to ever remove home entirely from your heart, whether or not that's positive or negative. So I think whenever I talk about home, that's the place that I'm describing. And
you're actually talking about a village near Chipping Norton, are you?
Yeah, Heathrop. So
is that very rural? It sounds beautiful.
I mean, it's about 3 miles away from Chipping Norton, which when you're a teenager without a car is not ideal. But as you grow older, you come to love the fact that it's isolated. And it's very close to a place called Heathrop Park. So it was originally built at the end of the 19th century as housing for all of the workers in the estate. Oh. And then over time became private houses. But I believe that my mum's house has actually only ever had 3 owners, which is quite nice. And up until the 1990s, it was actually connected to a spring nearby. It only became part of the water mains in 1990s, I think late 1990s, in fact. But it's stunning around there. It's undulating hills. And nearby, there's actually some Neolithic monuments as well, going back to what Karen was saying. There's the Rollwright stones, which I think have always fascinated me slightly. There's all of these stories that I think it's about witches. I can't quite remember what the stories that surround that place are. But again, nobody knows exactly why they're there, other than that they probably serve some symbolic purpose. And that's not the history that I study, because I like to have a little bit more certainty. But it's fascinating nonetheless.
Very good. And it certainly gives the place atmosphere.
Exactly.
And Alex, when did you last send a postcard?
So this is probably my dark secret. I collect and buy postcards, even postcards that aren't from the period that I study. But I don't really very often send postcards to people. My partner sends postcards very frequently to myself and her family when she's away. But I seem to collect postcards more for my personal enjoyment than to share an experience with others, which probably subverts their intended purpose somewhat. But I have a lot of postcards on my fridge, which are representative of different moments on holidays. And I have a increasingly large collection of postcards from the First World War.
I thought you were going to say you had an increasingly large fridge.
No, I wish I did, though.
Imagine upgrade your fridge because you bought too many postcards. Anyway, it's a stupid idea.
I'm sure some people have had to do that in the past. But yeah, I've got an increasingly large collection of First World War postcards rather than large fridges. And I mean, you don't really need to prove that you're more of a geek than when you do a history PhD, but somehow I've embraced that and have now developed a postcard collection which annoys my partner.
Before we see and hear about the cards that Alex and Karen have prepared for us today, I'll give you a quick one of mine. And this is Hailing Island. It's a multi-view, 4 images, and the images are of... They tell you what they are. But they're beach scenes and a pub on the harbour, a pub called the Royal Oak, which looks very nice. There's some swans in the water, which would doubtless have sandwiches thrown towards them when people were drinking their pint of ale. It's a Constance card. I rather like Constance as a publisher. And fun enough, at one time they were based just down the road from where I'm sitting right now in Streatham. At this stage they were in Littlehampton. And it says, having a list is sent to Woking in Surrey, you know, that far from the coast anyway, really, 1973. It says, dear ELS, I don't know, that's someone with those initials, or it's three people. It says, having a lovely time, weather is smashing. I'm missing our telly, but I shall make up for it when we get home. And it's from Rosie and Donna. I just thought the idea of being on holiday and saying how much you're missing watching television seemed an unusual and rather pedestrian message, really.
I mean, that's the great thing about postcards written from people on holiday. They're real streams of consciousness, aren't they? If they read them back afterwards, they think, why? What was I thinking? But they're just something that people just dash off in the moment, I think.
You're right. You can't even correct it like you'd correct a text message.
Exactly.
Yeah. I like the idea that... Go on.
Sorry. No, I was going to say that depressingly, that reminds me a lot of my my younger self on holidays, desperately seeking out English television whilst we're in the most beautiful surroundings in the south of France or in Italy, and my poor parents pulling their hair out trying to work out whether the house we were approaching had actually got an English television. Otherwise, I was going to be stomping my feet. Thankfully, I've grown out of that now.
Yeah, you've almost grown out of it.
Just about.
Well, now we're all worried about the Wi-Fi signal.
Exactly.
But I like the idea that there's a sort of a balance in the world, that if you go a week without watching television, you kind of make up for it when you get home. Especially in those days, television was completely linear. You couldn't catch up on anything. You just literally have to watch more of it. You couldn't catch up on those episodes of Neighbours you missed. You'd just have to watch Neighbours and then something else. Hailing Island looks very nice there. There's something about the colour on those Constance cards that I do find very, very evocative. They're not sort of super saturated like a John Hind card, and they're not all faded like a J.R. the Dixon card. They just hit the sweet spot. Yeah, well done, Constance. I should remind those of you listening at home that images of these cards, including the one I've been rhapsodising over, are on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can see that these are real cards that we're talking about. We're not making it up. We're not dreaming them. Now, Karen and Alex, you've both been kind enough to do your homework. You've dug out some cards for this long-distance remote recording to share with each other and with our listeners and with me. And, Alex, let's start with you. The first card you're going to talk about, that actually is kind of germane to the work you've been doing, I think.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating example of the things that I've encountered in the archives, actually. But I mean, to be true to the show, I've chosen something from my collection rather than a picture of something that I located in situ.
Very good.
And it's a studio image, although sometimes these were actual photographs that were then printed as postcards. In other circumstances, there were photographs which were then painted. I'm not entirely sure which one this would be. It looks like it's a true photograph, though. And it's of a British soldier, although I'm not entirely sure that his uniform is entirely authentic, kissing the cheek of a beautiful young lady who looks very happy about that fact, and they're holding hands and she's caressing his neck. I think they're just holding hands, although perhaps there might be something else going on there. The hand is very close to the breast.
To the heart,
exactly, yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing about these postcards, is that often they're seen as this emblem of modernity, but often they're very classical images that are used on them, at least at this stage. So the heart is a much more likely motif, although there were cards which played on less classical themes, shall we say. And there is a message, printed message, that lies below that says, here are kisses for you, and a series of X's. And it's from a series, actually, interestingly, seemingly printed by a French producer, since it says Paris on the other side of the card, which really gives a sense of just how international the postcard market was at this stage. These were produced for an English-speaking audience because there were so many British, Australian, New Zealand, Canadian soldiers in France, but produced by a French company nonetheless. And then we move on to the second side of the cards, and these are the kind of things that really fascinate me, because they really give you a glimpse into a moment of history, and it's almost like they're reaching out at you. And it was written by an unknown soldier who hasn't put his name here, which suggests that the recipient would have recognized the handwriting, interestingly. And it was written on the 13th of September 1917. This is concurrent with the Third Battle of Ypres, although the unit that this soldier was in, because we do know that, it was the 1st, 5th South Staffordshire Regiment. They weren't in the Ypres salient, thankfully for them, although this is the day before they went into the trenches, which
Goodness.
Probably gives another layer to why the soldier might have been writing this message. And so, interestingly, there's one block of writing and then some other little notes scribbled in. So it says, "Dear Miss Smith, just a PC postcard hoping you are well. It seems ages since I saw you. Please remember me to all your brothers." And then uh-huh. at the top corner, it also says, "Write soon." And then in smaller handwriting, just under "Dear Miss Smith," it says, "Write to a lovely soldier in the 1st, 5th South Staffs, France." Oh,
so that gave you the clue.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is the kind of thing you see quite frequently in letters and postcards. It's this desire to be remembered to all at home, and because we have these glimpses of the soldiers' lives, but actually these are momentary. These are a very small part of their daily routine, and it gives you a sense of the kind of things they were thinking about outside of the time they had to write letters and cards home. A preoccupation with people thinking about them on the other side of the English Channel. And then the really fascinating thing to me, and I probably spend far too much time doing this part, is looking at the address and thinking about what that means. And so this was sent to Miss H. Smith. It looks like Suppenhurst, but I think it's Tuppenhurst Farm, Armitage, near, is it Rugglery?
Rugely, I think.
Rugely,
there we go. Staffordshire,
that's your
England.
Part of the world, I think, isn't it, Karen?
It is.
Not so far.
Yes, it's definitely Rugely.
Do you know Rugely at all?
Well, I'm from the Midlands, so I know of it. I don't know anybody that lives there, but yes.
You don't know Miss Smith by any chance?
Yeah.
I don't know any descendants of the Smiths, I'm afraid.
It's an easy guess, Smith, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's true. Although the interesting thing is that Tuppenhurst Farm is still there. They have a farm and cafe. And
wow, have you been?
No, I should go.
Straight after lockdown.
Exactly. It was a recent discovery. They claim to be the same family that have owned it for 100 years, which means that I don't think they would quite be the Smiths, but I know that the farm was sold. At this point, I think it probably would have been part of an estate. But I did
and
look
at... And it would be her brothers,
woman.
Probably, who took over the farm.
Maybe not one of them, because I looked at the war memorial, or the records of the war memorial in Armitage, and there is a Smith who died in 1917. Uh-huh. So one does wonder whether or not all of those brothers would have been able to receive the remembrances of the right. sender.
Gosh. It's very interesting, and lots of things occur to me. Looking at it, I don't look at these First World War cards very often, and I will look more at them having spoken to you and read what you've been writing. And one thing that strikes me about these is often an image you'll see is the soldier dreaming of life at home and the sweetheart at home in a little thought bubble, isn't it? And you've got a sort of discolouring on this that looks a bit like it might be where that thought bubble would often sit. And I just wonder if there was a sort of development of images that you would have seen in Victorian England, where you would have had, it would often be thoughts of family at home or father is away, and the family are thinking of father, or father is thinking. And that sort of transposed into more of a romantic thing during the First World War, when so many young men were away, because often they're dreaming and thinking of lovers at home or sweethearts at home rather than children necessarily. I mean, is that nonsense, or is there a sort of slight that aesthetic kind of shift during the First World War?
I think that it does play on that aesthetic. I mean, most of the motifs that or many of the motifs one sees in cards are things that were picked up from the pre-war culture and adapted for, like you said, the reality of a war where so many men were away from home. And it's not just that, though, I think, although it's hard to disentangle where culture starts and ends. So you also see similar imagery in the diaries and letters and soldiers' journals written by soldiers at the time. And so it's a combination of both playing on pre-war tropes and also really adapting the card designs to things that were meaningful to soldiers that existed in their internal culture. So you often really genuinely see the same descriptions. And so when they were picking up a card, often it represented something that would have taken many more words for them to convey. And equally, many of these soldiers were semi-literate. They benefited from the Edwardian education system. It doesn't mean that they were willing to or able to create well-worded narratives of how they felt about the world. And that it might also have been anathema just to their culture. And so I think that it both plays on those pre-war tropes and it also genuinely depicts the kind of things that soldiers were thinking and feeling at the time. And equally, I think that they play a part in helping soldiers make sense of what was going on at the home front as well. So you don't see the reality of the home front in these imaginary bubbles. You see a home which is constructed around the pre-war norms. So the men are still the breadwinners and the women are waiting at home. Their parents are waiting at home. Their children are waiting at home for them to return.
Just waiting, really.
Just waiting, exactly. Not living their lives in a way that might make the soldiers who are disconnected from them anxious.
Yes. And in a way that because the world is frozen, the world to some extent is holding their breath, a phenomenon we're used to now in a different way. But this sense that back home, everything is just, it'll all pick up again, but we just have to wait. We have to go through, for the young men, a dreadful ordeal.
Exactly. I think that's the pandemic has created so many parallels in the things that I've been writing about and thinking about as I prepare my book. And I will say that I used the term new normal in my book manuscript before COVID struck.
Good
and
work.
I have to put a footnote which explains that. But when
no
you
one's
have
gonna
a
believe
future...
You.
Well, I know. I mean, I it's ruined it for me. But when you have a future that's so uncertain, hard to construct, and I think if we look back at least the first lockdown, that was something that we all experienced, you have to look to the past as a way to make sense of the present.
Yes.
And those imageries, the imagery of soldiers thinking about these classical structures of home, that is part of that process. It makes sense of their present for them.
Yeah. I want to ask you one practical question about this, which you may not know the answer to, because this is a French card, and it's a French card that probably never got sold in Britain. It would have just been sold in France because it was specifically for servicemen. Is that right?
I couldn't say that for sure, but my suspicion is that is the case, yes.
And if that is the case, sounds like I'm in a court of law. I'm not trying to catch you out. But the bit I have trouble understanding is quite how these cards were bought by the soldiers. Did people go? Did French people come up to them with, you know, a box of them on a tray, or did they happen to pass a village that the sort of the nuts and bolts of the consumption, the transaction, I find feels very vague in my mind. I can't kind of picture it.
Yeah, I think this is another one of those ways in which the postcard is a fascinating window onto another part of a history that you might not have expected to encounter. So the world behind the trench lines was one that still contained civilians. In some areas, they'd left because it was too dangerous. But in many of the towns and villages that soldiers occupied behind the front lines, sometimes only a few miles behind the front lines, there were still civilians. And many of them adapted their local economies to suit their new reality.
Right.
So they opened estaminets, small cafes for soldiers. And they would also sell trinkets to them.
Right.
Another really fascinating postcard of the First World War, of postcard typology of the First World War, is these knitted or sewn postcards.
Oh, yes. And the woven silks. Not the woven silks, the embroidered silks.
Exactly that. And those were things that actually some civilians would make and sell directly to the soldiers. But you would also have shops that I think would import these cards and then sell them to them. And in base camps, there were YMCA establishments that would also sell things like this.
Right.
And also some really big towns where there were still a lot of shops. And they would surely have brought in produce which was attractive to their new clientele, mainly English-speaking clientele.
Of course,
And so each of these cards is a moment in which a British soldier interacted with somebody of another national background. And there are so many lost stories there. But sometimes you do see a soldier writing, I picked this up off a wonderful old French lady. I've been showing this postcard to all of my French companions. And so you do get momentary glimpses of these interactions between the British soldiers and the French civilians. But I think it was almost certainly bought from a French shop or a YMCA establishment that sold things like this to the British soldiers.
And the photograph probably taken in Paris then?
Yeah, one would imagine, which would explain why the uniform looks like it might be slightly off.
I mean, generic, isn't it?
It's a bit generic, and I'm not one of those historians that is so hot on exactly what uniforms look like at different periods of the war. But I'm sure if you showed this to somebody with that kind of eye, they would pick out flaws with it.
But sensibly, they've put quite a lot of his detail in shadow. Rather beautifully, exactly, actually, because the light is all on her. It's a lovely piece of photography.
Yeah, I agree.
Very good, very good. Well, we're going to hear more about the First World War. We'll leave the trenches there for the minute. Karen, now, what's the first card that's landed on your doormat? We've got something a bit, I think this is referred to normally as a novelty, isn't it?
This dates from the same era. This is, as you call it, a novelty card with an oyster on it. And it's an unposted card, but with a very lovely message on the back. Now, this is quite sentimental to me, this card. It comes from a collection of about 50 postcards that I inherited from my mum. She acquired them from her next-door neighbour when she grew up in Birmingham in a terraced house, youngest of six. And next door was this chap called George Friend. And they had this very unlikely friendship, but it was a very sweet one. And he had this collection of postcards, and they were mostly written by him when he served in the First World War. So this card is actually written by George to his sweetheart.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of strands going on with this card.
Yes, as often is the case.
It is, and it's quite interesting because a lot of the cards that are in this collection are very similar to the ones Alex was describing. There are embroidered cards and cards in sets, you know, telling stories of mourning lost loves and regretting losing their lost loves, and that they're absolutely beautiful. And it was very difficult to actually choose this one. But I chose this one in particular because we used to look at these as children, as my mum would have looked at with Mr. George. She would have looked at these cards with him as a child as well. And this one in particular, because it's quite amusing for a child, I think, because the question is, what noise annoys a noisy oyster? And you open it up, and inside there is a rather sort of harassed chap with a child standing there going, why? A noisy noise annoys a noisy oyster.
And I should explain that the shell, the grey shell of the oyster, flips down to reveal this image behind it. And it's a domestic scene with a bloke in his pyjamas and a wailing child, I think.
Yes. You know, as a young child, we found this hilarious, and it's actually quite, you know, we looked after these postcards as children because it's still intact. You know, you can still, it's not come away at all.
And that's rare, I think, with these.
It is rare.
Because kids play with them, as simple as that.
But we loved going through these postcards, and we looked after them very well. And I think things like this stick with you as well. I mean, in recent years, myself, my other half, my mum and my sister, we were doing some sort of silly quiz. And the question was, what noise annoys a noisy oyster? And my mum, myself and my sister in unison, sing-song unison, all to the bemusement of my other half, just sang out, you know, a noisy noise annoys a noisy oyster. So things like
it's
that
stuck
do stick
in your
with
brain.
You. It was unrehearsed completely, yes. All three of us. So
brilliant.
That was quite a nice shared moment, both from our childhood, my mum's childhood, and also, you know, more recently as well.
Yeah, it takes you back to sort of, where does that jingle, that jangle of words come from? Is it? Do you think it's like an Edwardian music hall song or something? Or
It was obviously because I've seen it in other contexts as well, sort of, you know, in sort of jokes, you know, sort of probably other cards actually.
It's very pleasing. It does something to your brain, doesn't it? It's fun. Way that the bits of your brain to do with language get a kind of it's like having a slug of alcohol or something. Something strange happens for a minute.
It is
a split second.
There is, there's another card in this collection as well. It's a nut, and that similarly opens out, and there's a joke there. I can't remember what it is because it's the oyster one that really is the one that stuck with me, I think.
Yeah.
So it means a lot to me because it meant a lot to my mum as well, you know, who's no longer with us. So that's how I've inherited these cards.
It's quadruply powerful and resonant.
Yes, there is, but they're a lovely collection to have, and, you know, I'm very... I love having them because it's part of her, and I now, you know, part of her memories and now my memories too. But
this is printed by Alfred Stiebel, isn't it?
Yes, it's interesting.
They specialised in these novelties.
Yes, I've not actually seen this particular one anywhere else. But, you know, they must be out there somewhere, perhaps.
I could be getting this wrong, but I think a certain number of embroidered cards, certainly... Or maybe I'm thinking more of the woven cards. Were issued under the Alpha name. I think it was the woven cards. So I don't think this company made them, but I think they distributed them, and that Alpha brand was on them. So there's even more of a connection with those First World War cards. But what's the message? Can you decipher it for us?
Yes, I can. My years as an archivist come in handy.
Excellent.
So it says. So this is from George to his sweetheart. My only darling, have just received your letter, dearest, but haven't time to answer it, as we're off to Scotland right away and there isn't time. So I've just had to scribble a postcard, but will answer your letter as soon as possible, dear. With all my love, from yours forever, George. Which is lovely. But the sad thing is, George never married, so we don't know who this sweetheart was. The fact he has it in his possession.
It didn't do the trick.
No, it obviously never reached. Well, we presume it didn't reach his sweetheart. But there are other cards in there as well, written to his love, also to his sister as well. Uh-huh. The family lived in Greenwich at the time, moved to Birmingham subsequently, and he lived next door to my mum with his father and his sister, although they were long gone by then. And he died when my mum was 19, and she was passed these postcards because. They meant a lot to her as she grew up, and she kept them. They were actually in a brown paper bag for many years, which slowly disintegrated over time. And I've now got them in a nice little archival box, or you know, nicely protected. So,
finally, someone knows how to look after things.
I did my best.
There was all kinds of debate and discussion about whether you were allowed to send these through the post. I think the suggestion was you should have used a penny stamp because they weren't true postcards because they had other things going on. Which is maybe why it was sent. If it was sent at all, it would have been sent in an envelope.
Mm. I mean, it's quite interesting the fact that it's back in his possession. So whether she returned it then to him,
almost as a formal thing, sort of.
Yes, we'll never know. I guess
it feels a bit like something out of Jane Austen, doesn't it? Returning your letters.
It is. We don't even know the name of his only darling. So
the thing I love about this postcard is it really. It really gives you a sense of how postcards were used by individuals as well. So this is part of a wider communication system between George and whoever this unknown love was. And it was used just to bridge gaps between the other letters between them. And I wonder what they included. How much more effusive was he in those? How many times was he not responded to?
Well, it's true, isn't it? Because often postcards are seen as the poor relation of the letter. And it's something that I observe a lot, with people saying, I'll be sending you a letter soon, or sorry, I haven't written you a letter. But because postcards are pretty, the postcard survives. And the letter, you know, there is not the huge archive. I mean, I'm sure there are many letters out there, but not in the same way that people keep them to collect them in a straightforward way. A letter is so personal, so it only has the words and the meaning. A postcard has this sort of public element to it, so you can put it in an album, you can keep it in a drawer. It isn't always, it doesn't have, it's not overburdened with sort of emotional power.
Mm. I mean, changing the subject, so I just like the way that this is written slanted. You know, it's not following the rules of writing it across straight. Does that? I mean, that happens quite a lot, doesn't it, with postcards? You can get people writing diagonally across them, and
also more so in those early days, I think, than now.
Mm. That's interesting, isn't it, in itself?
Yeah. No. Yes. I mean, I know about angled stamps. I don't really think about angled writing. But also, the writing is so different from what we have now. Writing changes so quickly. You know, this is 100 years ago, and the writing is... You'd be very hard-pressed to find anyone in this country who writes like that. It's just different. It's just different now.
It reminds me of my grandmother wrote very much like that. Maybe she was taught by somebody of the same generation as George, but her handwriting looked almost exactly like this. But then the conventions in the language as well are very different to what one would find now.
Yeah. Although, I mean, funny enough, a few phrases do kind of stay the same across the whole life of postcards. And then I must say, one of the things that I like about old postcards is how often the message feels very immediate and modern and spoken, because the way words are put together, the way language, the sentences are structured in postcards is often closer to speech than it is to formal writing. This is relatively formal, actually, but it's very openly emotional.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the fascinating thing about postcards at this time is that they gave an excuse for people to be emotional. It's much easier to be emotional in a card that's already emotional.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's like having a greetings card saying, you know, I hope you have a lovely birthday. Half the work is done for you. If you want, you can just sign it.
Mm.
It's sort of in industrialized emotion. It's been done for you in a factory, in a printing press. They've already done half the feeling for you, which for British people is perfect.
Exactly.
Yeah, we all struggle with that. Very, very good. Oh, look, that is a fantastic card, and you know, that's not leaving your archival box, but I think there are collectors who'd find that very interesting because it's all in one piece and it's such fun.
It is. It's a great one. I'm glad I chose that one. Although I did find it, as I say, difficult. There were just so many to choose from.
That would have been better if we'd been in the room together.
We could have had the reveal.
Yes. But no.
The reveal is everything. The reveal is the best bit.
Yeah. No, it's great. Very good. Thank you. I'll do another quick one of mine. This is Liverpool Cathedral. These are very modern cards compared with these wonderful First World War and equivalent cards we've been looking at. This is a card published by Dennis, one of the great old publishers, using their photo colour process, they call it. Just a slightly washed out colour card, really. And I can't see the date on it. It's 60s. It's pre-decimal, definitely, because there's three penny stamps on it. And it was sent to Miss Anderson at Guy's Hospital, southeast London. And, well, it's not really South East London, it's South London, but it's an SE postmark. It says, weather lovely, but having a nice time. Went up to coast for 4 days, 3 days, last week. Otherwise, haven't done anything much. Please, could you see if you can get tickets for Pete Seeger's concert at Albert Hall on October the 2nd, and see if Joan Baez is doing one. She's in Manchester, in brackets. Hope works all right. See you soon. Love, Kate. So I suspect Kate also works at the nurse, Guy's Hospital as a nurse, because she's written to Miss P. Anderson at the nurses' homes. And anyway, she was asking her friend to try and get her some tickets to go and see the great folk singer, Pete Seeger. And she couldn't get onto Google to find out whether Joan Baez was also going to be appearing that night at the Albert Hall. So we'll never know if she got the tickets or she had a good time. I like to think she did.
Yeah, I think she probably did. Yes.
So I don't know. There's something about it. The sort of birth of the American folk movement at the same time as a large lumpen picture of Liverpool Cathedral. Sent to Guy's Hospital.
It's the contrast. Things,
yeah, and sort of meaning flying in all different directions at once.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are historians Alex Mayhew and Karen Averby. Well, here's a surprise. We've received a postcard. And the postcard is a lovely card of a Mountie on a horse, on horseback. It says Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the postmark says, "Why wait for spring? Do it now." And the card is from Mrs. Rotor of Toronto, Ontario, and she says, "I think the answer is $7,722.85. Well, sorry, Mrs. Rotor, I'm afraid that's the wrong answer. Right, let's get on with the postcard stories. Alex, what's the second card you've got for us today?
Yeah, so these are probably, in terms of the way that they're produced and the content, slightly more familiar to a modern eye. They look much more like the touristic snapshots that we're used to. And it's part of
But what an image.
What an image. So before I move on to the image, I'll give you a brief overview. It's part of a series, and you have many of these series during the war, of historic Arras, which is a town in the north of France. It used to be part of the Spanish Netherlands. So it's very beautiful. It's got Baroque architecture up to its neck. And many of these series existed of these towns that were subjected to the violence of the First World War. And what they did is they charted the violence. So in this case, it's by a producer who'd produced a series of cards like this over the course of the war. But this is showing the destruction between 1914 and 1916. So it misses the worst battle of the war, or the worst battles of the war around Arras, which were in 1917 and 1918. And what this one shows is it's Le Petit Place, so the small square in Arras, and the ruins of the Hotel de Ville. Just as an aside, when I was a child and we went to France, I used to think, oh, every town has a town hotel, and I don't understand why.
And quite grand. I know,
quite grand town hotels, but I haven't seen anybody going in or out.
Exclusive.
But as we know, it's a city hall. And I think that the thing that draws me to this series, and the reason I bought it as well for my collection, is twofold. Firstly, I follow quite closely the story of one soldier called Captain G.K. Rose, who served in one of the territorial units of the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry during the war, so close to home as well.
Right.
And he produced a series of sketches from this very square during this very year, but from between those columns you see in the background. So you can see the Baroque houses on the far side of the square behind the ruins of the town hall.
And the whole square would have been surrounded by this sort of colonnade, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be...
Yeah, it is to this day. They actually reconstructed Arras after the war. About three quarters of the city was in ruins, particularly after 1917-1918 battles. And you can see the square in its full glory today. And you walk under the under the columns, and there's shop fronts underneath there and some restaurants. But I like to think that Captain G.K. Rose is sitting underneath those columns in the darkness behind there at this very time the picture was taken. But also, it speaks to me a little bit about me and my dad have, over the years, gone on many what he likes to describe as boys' trips, although I think girls were very much allowed. It just so happened it was the two of us. And we went to a lot of old battlefields because my dad's an economist, but I think he always wanted me to be a historian. So he's lived his life vicariously through my academic pursuits. And one of our last trips was to the Western Front. This was 2019, so one of the last trips before COVID struck and made that impossible. And we went to Arras, and we actually went into the reconstructed Hotel de Ville, and you can go down into the basements, which survived the bombardments. Arras has a series of very deep basements connected to the old quarries from the medieval mining days there. Right. And actually soldiers used to live in them to avoid the bombardments. Gosh. And so we actually walked around the reconstituted Hotel de Ville. So I hadn't seen an image of it in its less glorious days. And I don't know, it was just one of those strange moments. When you study the war, you often wonder, okay, what would have it been like to be there at the time? And these kind of postcards give you a really vivid window into exactly what it would have looked like for the soldiers trying to describe it in their letters home. And then when you've been there, it adds this other dimension. Quite perversely, I think a lot of historians kind of wish they could have seen it as it was destroyed. And this, I guess, it's the best opportunity to do so without having to put oneself in danger and see all of the fairly morbid sights that accompanied the destruction.
But there are many, many cards like this, aren't there, of destruction of towns in France. I don't remember as a kid used to see them in like jumble sales and stuff. They were the most common cards you'd see in a way. And I wasn't really collecting postcards then, but the sort of blasted towns. And there is something sort of curious about them because it's almost like a sort of surrealistic fantasy of destruction of the urban. After a while, it becomes not more than photojournalism. It becomes a sort of celebration of the ruin. As what more ruined image can we find? What angle can we put more blocks of stone in the foreground? It's a sort of strange aesthetic that develops.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost fetishizing the destruction. I have found a postcard sent by a soldier home, which showed a slightly destroyed school in a nondescript village along the Western Front. And the main message on the postcard said, "I'm sorry, dear, I wanted to get a better picture of ruins, but this is the only one I could find."
It says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing. The soldiers were also tourists as well as being, as well as being servicemen. And for many of them, it was their first time abroad. Equally, many of the officers or wealthier rank and file would have had opportunities to travel and may have actually seen these towns in their former glory. So having these postcards shows something else. But they're also part of the propaganda campaign, right? So this is actually a less aggressive one, but you often see these destroyed towns, particularly Ypres, Albert on the Somme, and they'll have accompanying messages which say, an example of the destruction of the ghoulish vampires. And it gives you a real sense. I mean, I think we forget this today, generally in popular culture, but the way that the Germans were portrayed in the First World War was very akin to the way the Nazis were portrayed in the Second World War. You had to convey a sense of this demonic enemy. And the best way to do so is to take these beautiful cities, examples of often medieval culture, if you go to Ypres, but in here, early modern culture and wealth in the Spanish Netherlands, and just show what the destruction of war does. I mean, it's really similar. I don't know if you, I'm sure you guys remember, but when ISIS started destroying Palmyra and all of those other sites in Syria, in many ways it was the destruction of heritage and history more than the loss of life which really pushed people to want to intervene. I mean, there's something really perverse and slightly unsettling about the way that the destruction of history often has a greater impact on people's horror of war than, I mean, these loose reports of casualties do.
Yes. And that, yeah, absolutely right. And I don't know if it's a sort of genuine sense that we're losing our patrimony, our inheritance with the cultural inheritance, or whether it's just that we're a bit weird about stones. I mean, you can sort of look towards the whole separate thing, but the whole statue debate that goes on now, we get funny about things that are made of stone. I think it's because they represent permanence, and we're scared if permanence isn't quite so permanent.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, buildings are meant to outlive us, right? And
yeah,
we all accept our own lack of permanence. But once you see history disappear, it adds a...
Is nothing stable?
Yeah, exactly.
It's real. I feel it. I'm not mocking. I think... And you know, when we saw Palmyra being destroyed, we were shocked. It was upsetting. I think this particular image is particularly powerful with this... You know, it looks like a sort of enforced quarry in the foreground, just blocks of stone. But then such an elegant, beautiful side to the square in the background. I mean, it's very, very articulate. It says it all. It's all there in the image.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree.
I was just thinking as well, it's very romanticised, and it reminds me very much the way that the image is looking. You've got there, as you know, when you have old postcards of castles and ruins and follies and that sort of thing, you've got, you know, just to the side there, you've got that building on the right, and you've got the rubble in the foreground, and it's just that sort of, it's very evocative, and I just wonder, you know, obviously that is deliberately chosen by the photographer, but it just reminded me of a ruined castle, you know, the ones with the single towers remaining.
Corfe Castle or something.
Yeah, possibly, yes, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's like it's arrived in the middle of an urban environment. Mm. You just plonk it there. Yeah,
the juxtaposition
is so powerful.
Yeah, and all of those kind of images that Karen was describing are really popular at this time as well. I mean, that period at the end of the 19th century where there was an obsession with distant history. I mean, we were talking about this at the beginning of the podcast, but that's the kind of thing that's used to start to create narratives about British national identity. So it's probably not surprising that these kind of images were then popular during the First World War.
Yes, and, you know, we are still in the earlier days of lots of cameras being used in the open air, using natural light. You know, photography was still not everywhere the way it is now.
Mm.
And you've got the wrapper as well for these. So have you got the whole set? Or?
Interestingly, there's two that are missing from the very front. I'm just looking at it now. So I've got most of the set. But clearly, whoever purchased this did have time to send two of the postcards.
Right.
Now, they're the first two, so it looks like they plan to send them all. But often what they would do is they'd send these series home as a memento for themselves as much as for their families. And, I mean, I think the really fascinating thing is for a long time we assumed that the world of the soldier and the world of the civilian were entirely disentangled and that there was this chasm of understanding between them. But these are the kind of postcards which really give you a sense of just how untrue that is.
Yes.
Soldiers were able to convey the sights they saw and to chart the world they lived in a very vivid and often really visceral way. The only thing missing from this series is the dead. But, I mean, there was good reason to not send pictures of the dead to your loving and worried family.
Well, quite. And, you know, they're not photojournalists. They're people having to mediate everything, and they know who they're talking to. They don't want to upset them.
Exactly.
Very good, very good. Well, I feel like I've had an insight into First World War postcards, which actually has, of course, piqued my interest, and I want to go and look at more and see what I've got sitting in a box somewhere and kind of assess them anew, which is really, really good. Thank you. Now, Karen, what's the final card you've got waving in your hand? What have you got for us?
Yeah,
this is a modern card,
literally. Yes, it is literally waving in my hand. I'm holding it quickly and looking at it and smiling. So yeah, this brings together several strands. I mean, I think it's very difficult to choose one postcard that sort of encapsulates several things. Well, yes. but this is the Grand Hotel in Torquay, and it also shows you Corbin Head Beach there with various beach huts. It's a 1980s beach scene, so it's very modern. And it's the sort of postcard which, when I went on holiday and bought, you know, you buy various postcards to send to people back home, that I probably would have sent to the person I liked least, because, you know, you have scenes. Cuddly cats and that sort of thing went to my friends, and, you know, these sort of ones weren't, I didn't like them so much. But it's completely reversed now, of course. I buy postcards now, such as this one, because they... they show the buildings that I'm researching, you know, a slice of history at that very point in time. And I really like this one because it has beach huts and it has the hotel. They represent the two books that I've written about the seaside, one on beach huts, one on seaside hotel.
You didn't write a book about rusty railings at all then?
Not yet. I could okay. add that to the list.
Just keep this one in mind if you ever do.
Could be popular, could be quite niche. I'm not sure. But also, I wanted the Grand Hotel Torquay to be yes. on the front cover of my book. And I stood for a number of hours at this same vantage point trying to get a good photograph of this view as well. And it really wasn't a very good photo. And in fact, on the first, I think, mock-up of the cover, it is floating out around there on the internet, there is this very grey, dismal view of the Grand Hotel Torquay, and it's not very good. And I'm very glad, in fact, that the publisher went with another image altogether.
The picture you chose in the end is does make it look, well, not unlike a French chateau, but amazing. Well, the beach looks amazing. It just looks beautiful.
That's the Queen's Hotel in Eastbourne. Similar sort of, yes. It's a completely different hotel altogether.
That's why you know about these things and not me.
But I mean, you're right.
It does look of a piece, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they have got similar characteristics. Also, the Grand Hotel in Llandudno as well. Grand hotels, they reflected the architecture fashion of the time. So these grand hotels, you know, having turrets and, you know, they were built to impress in prime locations. So they really grab your attention. And that's why you get so many grand hotels subject of postcards as well, because they're landmarks, you know, in their own right, really.
Big, lumpy buildings that you could get on a postcard.
Yeah, well, some of them are a lot more elegant than others, I guess. But they sort of, you know, right from early postcards of these hotels, they're you know, very dominant and they're there. And what I particularly like about this postcard as well, if we turn it over and see who wrote the card, they actually mention the hotel as well.
So this is a card you've purchased secondhand?
This is one I've purchased secondhand, yeah. Yes, because it has all the elements that I kind yes. of liked. It's you know, it's got the hotel, it's got the beach huts. It's not too far away in time from when I went to from my childhood holidays, the very first holidays I went on as a child to Torbay, Torquay, and Paignton. We never stayed in a hotel. It was always self-catering, caravan, that sort of thing. And of course, living in Birmingham, growing up in Birmingham, we could be very fickle as to the seasides we visited. So,
oh, I see. Nothing was very close. So.
No, not really. Weston-super-Mare, I think. Yes.
Right.
The day trips to Weston. And then we'd, yes. When we had a car until I was about age 9. So we could go to North Devon. We went to Lincolnshire and also North Wales were the sort of mixed and match between those.
I never thought most people have a seaside that they consider to be sort of local.
Well,
but in
this
Birmingham,
is what I found
don't.
Out. Yeah, when I sort of, I think some people do go to the same place, but it's when I sort of mixed, you know, you get older and you move away from your hometown, and you realise that people used to go to the same seasides all the time, and I was just a bit shocked by that because we'd been around the coast at various places, and after I was about 9, my mum was a single parent, so it was anywhere we could get to on the train that was cheap and cheerful.
Right. So what would be the easiest place by train then for you?
Well, we went to Anglesey. We went to where else? We went to Mablethorpe.
Right.
A couple of times. So it was it was sort of and we went to Westwood Ho, Ilfracombe, that sort of thing. Lots of Brummies along the North Devon coast.
Right. Of course, when you go by train, you're kind of replicating the journey that a lot of people would have made in those early days of the sort of so after the First World War, probably, but you know, around that time.
Oh, absolutely. And the fun thing was, back in the 80s, you still had those old-fashioned trains with the individual carriages in them.
Right.
And you couldn't reserve your seats then. So it was my job as the eldest child to get on the train with a few bags and run and find a carriage that the four of us could sit in, like me, my mum and my two sisters as well.
Oh. Full of excitement, presumably.
Full of excitement and also terror because, you know, I was quite a shy thing at the age of 10 or whatever, trying to, you know, move through all the throngs of people. Was, you know, a little daunting, but it was, and then we'd get on and eat our sandwiches, whatever, it doesn't matter if it was 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, yeah, get that out of the way.
Yes, absolutely.
Brilliant,
so, yeah, yeah. Family holidays, so many memories and so many postcards I could have brought with me today, but there you go.
So what's the message on this one, this anonymous person? Well, we do know
yes.
who they are, don't we?
We know the addressee and we know that the person that wrote the card was called Mary.
Okay.
So they write, we've just had our lunch here at the Grand, met a lot of inner wheelers having their AGM. So Joan and Nana are well away having chats. I did have to look up who the inner wheelers were because I'm not sure.
Is it a Rotary Club thing?
It's kind of a women's network, and I think they have lunches at hotels, like a friendship groups, I think, that probably started in America. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to look them up, I think. I don't fancy having my lunches at grand hotels. That sounds great.
Got to learn something every day. You've made a new contact there.
Yes. And then, of course, they go on to mention the weather. The weather is dull, but I hope it will clear up. And they went yesterday to the Singer Mansion. Expect you have been there. And the Singer Mansion is a hotel in Paignton, nearby Paignton. It was a former mansion of the son of Isaac Singer, he of sewing machine fame. So sort of sightseeing a go-go. And also I like the fact he mentioned another hotel that I visited and enjoyed a cocktail or two in. So that was kind of a nice link there as well.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about these grand hotels because you see images of them all around the coast, and they were pretty well they were almost a definition of a sizable coastal town or seaside town.
Yes, absolutely.
But they all seem to have emerged individually. It's not like someone went round putting, like they might now, putting trust house fortes or whatever, holiday inns. All sort of emerged, I don't say organically, but from local businessmen seeing an opportunity and making it happen. It's strange. Yeah. There's a real sort of movement. It was in the air or in the bank balance.
It was a very lucrative business to get into. In fact, it did cause the ruin and the bankruptcy of quite a few individuals, unfortunately. But, they sort of emerged, the grand hotels emerged in the middle of the 19th century, and they were huge. They were big undertakings. They needed to attract a certain clientele of people. So when the railways came along and opened up the coast and you got sort of more and more different kinds of people visiting the seasides, there would be very many inns and, you know, I suppose the equivalent of bed and breakfast and that sort of thing. But you needed to attract the people with money, the aristocracy, the wealthy. So these grand hotels were very, very much set apart. They were monumental. They were, you know, quite foreboding. If you didn't belong there, you wouldn't have felt welcome there at all. Not just because they had staff on the door, but inside it would be very imposing entrances and different rooms for different activities, but, you know, sort of rooms just for men, like the smoking rooms, the billiard rooms. And then you'd have obviously various dining rooms, some of them private dining rooms as well. People would stay for the whole season in these places and they would go promenading or, you know, being driven in their horse and carriage up and down. They were there to be seen. So, yeah, building a grand hotel was an excellent way to make some money. And it's not until towards the end of the 19th century that you see the first sort of chain, what we'd call now chain hotels appearing. You've got Gordon Hotels. There's a chap called Frederick Gordon who'd made quite a lot of money building some hotels in London. And he saw the coast as an excellent opportunity. And he built a lot of hotels. A lot of them were called the Metropole. So, for example, the Metropole in Brighton. Was built there, and it, you know, a direct rival to the Grand Hotel, which had been in existence for a couple of decades already.
Brighton is kind of full of grand hotels of one kind. I mean, in the broader sense,
Brighton's amazing. The whole seafront, the whole history of the seafront hotels in Brighton is a fantastic history. You've got bankruptcies, you've got old hotels being swept away in favour of new modern 1960s monstrosities. I know some people do quite like those, but I'm not a fan. And yes, you've got that sort of whole development of history going on in that short space, geographical space as well.
I have this vision that you have these huge hotels. I think the only one I've ever stayed at, I stayed at one of the very big hotels in Blackpool years ago. For some work, and it was a bit, you know, it's probably lovely now, but it was a bit shabby probably 15 years ago.
These hotels, I mean, they've suffered quite a lot after the First World War, after they've been requisitioned, and the Second World War as well. You know, they were struggling to compete with the more modern buildings that were being constructed. And, of course, every new hotel that's built has all the mod cons. So if you've been around for 30 years, 30 years is a long time in technology. And when all these Edwardian hotels, for example, were being built at the end of the 19th century, their predecessor grand hotels from sort of the 1860s and 70s were struggling to compete. They couldn't have ascending rooms, which are lifts. You know, that they didn't have the latest technology in air conditioning or heating and lighting. So it was always a struggle. Every decade is a struggle for a big grand hotel.
Particularly,
and it's great
bathroom protocols as well.
Exactly. Oh my goodness, the ensuite. I mean, and, you know, also competing with fashionable cities as well, like London, you know, you know, which really was, you know, some amazing hotels there. I mean, staying in a grand hotel today can be quite an experience depending on where you stay. There are some that are just amazing and still give you that grand hotel experience, whereas others are more of a faded sort of grandeur experience. And I like both. I do like to stay at both.
I have this vision of one of these hotels in the 50s or something, when you got, I don't know how many rooms they had, 300 rooms or something, and in every room someone's sitting there writing a postcard.
Yes,
it was probably true. It was probably, especially if it's raining.
Yes. Well, that's what you do when you. That's when you write your postcards. It's when it's absolutely tipping down outside.
I think so.
With a caravan or hotel.
Yeah. Well, I'd have thought. I suppose holiday camps might have also impinged a bit onto the hotels, unless the hotels were always a bit too expensive for that.
I never stayed at a hotel until I was 20. We always went self-catering in a caravan or a chalet, or we did, and we went to a holiday camp in Mablethorpe, which wasn't a Butlins or a Pontins, but we had fun.
What was
It didn't matter. It was called Trussville Holiday Camp.
Oh, was it an independent
one? Had a great time there. I think it was. I think it might even still be there. Actually, it might still be open. I need to go and revisit it.
Yes. Well, we are allowed to go and visit our own coast at the moment, if nowhere else. So maybe we should take advantage.
Absolutely.
The escation word, but we are allowed to.
I mean, one thing is that's quite important. The hospitality industry has, you know, suffered quite badly over the last year or so. So it is important to go and visit our hotels at the coast. You don't need to stay there. You can go there for dinner or a cocktail or a special occasion meal, but they do need.
Who are you working for here? There's something going on here.
I'm an advocate for our built heritage, especially seaside heritage. So,
I think you're absolutely right. And you know what? I've not been during these various lockdowns. I've not been craving a trip to southern Spain. That would be nice. Mm. But I got to the stage one day. I just thought we've got to go to the seaside. I need to get some fresh air at the seaside. And there comes a point where you just need that, I think.
Which one would you go to?
Well, the easy one to walk the dogs for me is Saltdean near Brighton.
Oh, I love that.
Very near Peacehaven, where they were in that postcard.
And a very nice Art Deco hotel there that's no longer a hotel.
Yes, but that's flats now, is it?
It is. I mean, they've actually done a very good job. But yes, that was an amazing Art Deco hotel in the 30s. But thankfully, it's still there, but you can't sort of use it as a hotel, obviously, because it is flat, indeed.
Yeah. I've never poked around the outside. Maybe I should go and have a poke around there next time.
I think you should.
Can you go up to look at it, and is that all right? Or?
Well, it's flat, so I'm sure there's public access to a point.
Until they kick you out.
I feel like I'm in desperate need of exploring the English and British countryside and seaside. Now, I'm ill-informed of the architecture and nature of many of our best resorts.
For a shorthand, I recommend Karen's book on the seaside hotels. That'll get you started.
Oh, thank you.
The problem is it's like an I Spy book. You want to tick them all off.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when I was researching, I couldn't stay at them all, obviously. I'd be bankrupt. But I did try their bars and their cocktails and their G&Ts as I was working my way around the coast.
It's a wonder you got anything written.
Indeed.
Very good. Well, thank you for that rush of ozone from the seaside hotels. That's very good. And then thank you both for sharing your postcards today. I've said it before, I never know where the postcards will send us. I'm delighted you shared them with me, with each other, with the listeners. And quite a lot of history today, which is really interesting. Another quick reminder for listeners at home, images of all these cards with the right backs associated with the right fronts, are going to be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk. So if you feel we haven't described them sufficiently, you can look at the pictures too. And now before we let Karen and Alex both off the line, I've got one more postcard for you both. It's customary for us to end the show with one of these. Normally, I would hand this across to you and we could all enjoy it. It's the last card on your dope sheet. So what you've got there, I don't know if you can see it. Can you see a picture of a sort of a painting of a maybe Mediterranean harbour, little bay? Can you see that, Kate?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, and as you can see, there's a message on it, many happy returns of the day. And it's all sort of very subtle colours. It's sort of a chocolate box image, really, lots of rather faded colours. And there's a white blob in the middle. And, of course, that is the hole for a spindle to go in, because this is, as usual, a postcard that is also a gramophone record. Ooh. And this one, I think it's an English one. Often they're Hungarian or sometimes Polish. But this one is made by a company called Melody Cards of London. And the patent is still pending. Who knows when that patent will be approved? To be honest, they need to get the skates on now. Anyway, young Tom over at Wardour Studios has made a digital recording of this. I know because I watched him do it. And if we ask him nicely, he can play us the sound of the postcard.
Somebody loves me. I wonder who.
Hey.
I wonder who it can be.
Not bad.
I love it.
Somebody loves me.
I always say
the
same thing.
It's not my usual go-to music.
Is it? It's not bad for a piece of cardboard.
No, exactly.
Fantastic.
And in fact, they did produce these in Edwardian times, little ones.
Did they?
But I have not been able to get hold of one that I've managed to play yet. That Tux did them.
Fragile,
and
somebody loves me.
They're so tiny that the record players don't like to play that close to the spindle anymore. But I do need to get one of them going.
Oh, this is delightful.
It's not bad, is it? As a birthday card.
I think it's lovely. I wouldn't mind receiving one. Birthday's next month, by the way.
I'll see what I can do. I'll have a word with myself 40 years ago and see if I've got any of these left. Very good. Well, look, as the little harbour continues to rotate at exactly 45 revolutions per minute, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, and our pasts, and all our pasts, Alex Mayhew and Karen Averby. Thank you both, and thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardourstudios.co.uk.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.